Jewish prejudice and secure justice and fair treatment for all people alike, which we interpret as fighting hate, extremism, bigotry of all kinds. And we work in areas of legislation, we work in terms of education, and one of the things that we've been doing for almost a century now has also been monitoring and combating extremism from neo-Nazis and racist skinheads, anti-government militias, and QAnon conspiracies. This is a big part of ADL's mission because the extremists actually threaten the rights and protections that all Americans have.
Now, in some of your work, you've researched the evolving landscape of hate groups in the United States. And if you could talk to us about, you know, how both hate groups and hate symbols have changed over the last few decades, kind of big picture.
Well, let me just think for a second, then the best phrase is this. So whether we're talking about European countries or North American countries like the United States and Canada, far-right extremism motivated by hate, motivated by anti-Semitism, racism, prejudice, has unfortunately been a constant for decades now. Nazis, racist skinheads, Ku Klux Klan, the alt-right more recently. And these movements, more so than some other types of movements, have always relied very heavily on visual imagery and symbology. This goes all the way back to the Ku Klux Klan and the image of the burning cross or the Klansman in his robes, or to the Nazis with their Nuremberg rallies festooned with swastika flags and spotlights. So this sort of idea of visual imagery to create fear, to create for themselves a sense of grandeur, a sense of purpose, has always been really important. And that's certainly been true in both Canada and the United States over the years. But the symbols themselves are not always constant. There are some, like the swastika, like the blood cross of the Ku Klux Klan, or the burning cross. Decades old and still very powerful. Many of the symbols used by the Nazis in the 1930s and 1940s are prominently used by extremists today. But people evolve new symbols, they evolve twists on old symbols, they come up with other types of symbology, and so it is an evolving field, and someone looking at hate symbols today is not necessarily going to see all the same symbols that someone looking at them 50 years ago might have. And so it takes expertise, it takes people actually trying to find out what symbols people are using and why they're using them and what they mean. And seeing which ones fall out of use and which ones become popular. It's an important way to help keep track of these types of extremist movements and the ideas and the hate that they're spreading.
I'd love to hear more about the process of defining what a hate symbol is. It's something that came up in our council meeting where some of the counselors were curious about, you know, who gets to decide what a hate symbol is and how that process unfolds.
Well, essentially anybody can decide that something is a hate symbol, but there has to be sort of a consensus for other people to accept that definition. At the end of the Defamation League, when we look at symbols, for something to be considered a hate symbol, first of all, it has to be significantly used by extremists. But moreover, it has to be used by extremists in some way connected to their hate. So for example, extremists may use all sorts of symbols at different times, simply because something may be symbol may be popular and they want to exploit it. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're somehow giving it a hateful meaning. On the other hand, there are other symbols that are specifically designed to reflect or project anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim bias, anti-Black bias, anti-immigrant bias, anti-LGBTQ plus bias, some sort of hate. And so if you have symbols, and they can be visual symbols, they can be gestures, they can be, in some cases, even typographical symbols that are used by extremists and that are associated with hate or with hateful groups, then we consider them hate symbols. Now, extremists sort of pose or create hate symbols all the time, but most of them don't really get picked up by other extremists to become popular or to develop any sort of longevity. And they may rise today, and within a month or two, they fall into disuse and are discarded, and no one ever uses them again. And we don't typically have to worry about things like that. But other symbols, the ones that get traction, the ones that get some degree of popularity, that get some degree of longevity, those are the ones more likely to become problems. Symbols used to help recruit, symbols used to help intimidate, symbols used to help create a sense of shared belonging or purpose among different extremists. And those types of symbols, when they emerge, those are the ones that we are more concerned about.
One thing I find really interesting is, obviously, we're recording this in Edmonton. We're 4,000 miles away. You're out in the east. Are you joining us from New York or from Ohio?
I'm in Ohio. I'm in the Midwest. So you're probably about 2,000 miles away.
Yeah, a little bit closer. But you know, one thing our team was talking about was these hate groups, these hate symbols, these don't really know any boundaries or borders. Maybe talk to us about, we're going to get into technology in just a little bit, but maybe talk to us about how, you know, these problems are, you know, cities across not just North America, but the world are also facing, that these symbols don't know boundaries.
It's true. Hate symbols often don't have geographical boundaries. There are a lot of good examples of this. I mean, one example is the image of a Klansman and a hooded Klansman and a fiery cross. This is a very common subject for tattoos by extremists in Europe, in places like Sweden or Germany. At the same time, symbols adopted, exploited, or created by the Nazis are popular among white supremacists around the world. That's another unfortunate legacy that the Nazis left us. And one example for that is an example of the Sonnenrod. Sonnenrod is German for sun wheel, and sun wheels are an ancient symbol, sort of a circular symbol with rays emanating from a center. And one particular sun wheel was actually created by Nazi graphic designers and used by the SS. And that Sonnenrod became popular among neo-Nazis and other extremists and was used, for example, on the manifesto that Brendan Tarrant created prior to his shooting attacks at mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. And because of that, other white supremacists in other countries also use that Sonnenrad symbol on their own manifestos or graphics or guns in their own attacks in other places. And it just illustrates how if a symbol becomes powerful, it might not just be adopted by a group or a group of individuals, but by people with hatred in their hearts all around the world.
Getting into the technology piece, in your view, what role does technology have to play both in spreading these symbols through social media or online message boards, but also how can, and this will lead into Lighthouse, you know, how can technology also help combat and fight these hate symbols, and maybe what you've noticed over the last, you know, let's say short term, kind of 5-7 years even?
Well, certainly the main impact that technology has had, excuse me, I have the hiccups. Let me start that over. I think the main impact that that technology has had on hate symbols and transmission of hate symbols is to greatly increase its speed. I mean, prior to the internet, there was still an entire far-right communications ecosphere that consisted of print media, shortwave radio, computer bulletin boards, video cassettes, tape cassettes, all sorts of things like that. But the internet just makes things so fast and so cheap, and images are one of the things that can most easily be transmitted. And symbols also often transcend language barriers or other barriers. So, you know, someone in Slovakia might not know enough English to be able to read and comprehend Britain Terrorist Manifesto, but they can easily understand the significance of the symbols that he put on it or the symbols that he drew on his guns. And someone in a telegraph channel can now share symbols, memes, images instantaneously with other white supremacists all around the world. Or someone could do that on any other social media platform that is not properly moderated. And so, you know, this means that everything from ideas to tactics to hate symbols can just spread much faster than they could previously. Now, it is a two-edged sword. The same technology that extremists use to communicate can be used, for example, to help identify extremists. And there have been plenty of law enforcement cases built on using evidence gotten from extremist communications, electronic communications, or communications over the internet. Modern technology, which is now rapidly developing, for example, the ability to detect images online, just like it's developing the ability to detect faces online, can also, at some point in the future, have a lot of practical uses. But even now, just the ability, for example, for someone who sees a hate symbol, let's say they're driving to work and they see somebody sprayed a hate symbol or something that they think is a hate symbol on a wall or a business somewhere. Now, they can now photograph that, you know, with their cell phone and contact ADL if it's something in the United States and they want to know ADL about it. Or they can use a system like Lighthouse. You know, if they're a police officer who sees that symbol, a city worker who sees that symbol, they can immediately put that into a database, and then it becomes an intelligence data point. And over time, you can start to see patterns, you can start to see types of symbols, where symbols are being located, you can start to understand the phenomenon that can, you know, at some point help you deal with some particular problem. And so, you know, technology is always, you know, giving with one hand and taking away with the other hand. On the one hand, it certainly strengthens certain things that extremists like to do. But on the other hand, for people of goodwill and good intention, it helps them combat the problems that extremists cause.
I was really struck by CEO Jonathan Greenblatt's quote I'll quote it now. The failure by major states and cities across the country to report hate crime data essentially and inexcusably erases the lived experience of marginalized communities across the country. And maybe if you could maybe kind of riff off of that quote and maybe talk to us about, you know, data reporting, this kind of cataloging process, why this is so important. People may not think that, okay, so now we have an app that can catalog. What's the big deal? But it tells me it is quite a big deal, and it's a big step forward for addressing these issues.
Well, one of the most important things is that you may not even know you have a problem until you have data that illustrates that there's a problem. Because when things come to you sort of anecdotally, oh, there's this graffiti over here, or there was something that happened over here, I mean, you may hear about one or two of these incidents. Someone else on your team may hear about another one of these incidents. But they're not necessarily all put together. And no one ever, it's sort of like blind men looking at an elephant. No one ever necessarily gets to see the whole elephant. But when you have a system for reporting incidents, for reporting data, for collecting information, then you get to see the whole elephant. and you get to see if it's a big elephant, you get to see if it's a little elephant. You get to see if there are maybe two elephants in the room, and you only thought that there were one elephant in the room. I don't know how far I can go with this elephant analogy, but I mean, I think the key thing is that it's like giving you a third eye. It's like giving you a sense you didn't already have that allows you to see things, or the shape of things, or the dangers that things pose, or who may be behind certain things that you didn't have before. It gives you that additional insight. And it's very important.
And going into like the outcome we're looking for, so with tools like this, what is the outcome kind of tangibly in the community that we would like to see? When we were talking with David last week, you know, he was saying like he's very proud of this tool because at the end of the day, he wants a safe community for his kids and for everyone else's kids as well. And, you know, Edmonton is a growing city and other cities are growing. And whether you live here now, you're going to be coming here, you're yet to be born. You know, what's kind of the pie in the sky, blue sky kind of outcome that we would like to see with our communities and these issues?
Well, you know, ideally, it can help be an early warning system. Just like other types of early warning systems can help people understand that there's a tornado that may be coming, that action needs to be taken. Something that can detect and track hate symbols can give you that early warning that there may be a problem developing in your community. For example, just to give you one way, often extremists may start with something small, like vandalism. But as they grow in confidence and also grow more extreme, may progress to other types of targets, including attacking people. But if you can, you know, nip that in the bud while they're still at the vandalism stage, right? If you know there's a problem and you can devote resources to dealing with that problem, you know, you may be able to prevent much worse things from happening. And so, you know, you can only do that sort of prevention if you are really aware of your environment. And, you know, Lighthouse gives the citizens of Edmonton another way to be aware of that environment, of aware of the hate environment, and then to do something about it, to use that awareness to do something about it.
Awesome. And if you were to forecast through everything that you research and document, you know, what is the next, in your view, kind of next 3 to 5 years look like? If you could have forecast out, do you see these problems, you know, getting worse? Do you see kind of like an arms race between hate groups, hate symbols with the technology and the groups like ADL and municipal organizations like us kind of competing against each other to try to combat each other. Yeah, maybe just talk about kind of what the future looks like in the short term.
That's a more difficult question to answer because it depends so much on context. So for example, I think the future in the United States looks kind of grim. There's been a lot of mainstreaming of extremism in this country. And that trend seems to be more likely to increase than to decrease. Now, I don't necessarily have the same degree of knowledge or awareness of the internal Canadian situation to be able to suggest that there may be the exact same dynamics or similar dynamics, or to be able to suggest to what degree the convoys may be parallel to some of the things that we're having going on in the United States. So it's difficult for me to talk about that broadly. But what I can say is that right-wing extremism, especially hate groups, white supremacy, are causing significant problems in a lot of countries. And there doesn't, in most of these countries, this is something that does not seem to be going away. It does not seem to be decreasing. It seems like it is on the increase, and that more needs to be done in order to deal with the problem and try to make sure that it doesn't get worse still. And so, you know, I think the future in part, the future may depend upon how authorities, how police forces, how cities, how provinces and states and national governments actually recognize the problem, the nature of the problem, and then try to implement solutions, societal, judicial, others, to try and deal with it.
That's great. And maybe we'll, the last question I'll ask is really about those kind of partnerships and apps like Lighthouse. And maybe if you could maybe talk about, you know, why things like Lighthouse, partnerships between ADL, not just our city, but also cities around the world. You know, why are these partnerships and collaborations so important with regards to combating hate, some multi-hate crime?
Well, I think partnerships are really important because there's no sort of organization, governmental or non-governmental, that has all the resources, that has all the knowledge, that has all the solutions. We have decades of knowledge about hate symbols that few other organizations around the world have. But we don't have other things. We don't necessarily have reach into certain places. We don't necessarily have ways to turn that knowledge, to give that knowledge some sort of practical effect. But with a partner like Edmonton, for example, they can use our knowledge, combine it with their technological know-how and their local situation, in order to actually help deal with real issues on the ground. And that is something that neither party could have done completely on their own. That is something that can only be done by people working together. And to deal with the threat of hate, to deal with the threat of extremism, to deal with the threat of right-wing terrorism, you've got to have a partnership between and among non-governmental organizations of different types and with all sorts of governmental bodies as well. There was an incident in Arkansas, in the United States, a few years back, where a group of different white supremacists got together to firebomb the home of a multiracial family. And the perpetrators of this firebombing were all from, each one was from a different white supremacist group. But they all got together to perpetrate this hate crime. If they can get together to perpetrate hate, it's all the more important that we have to cooperate, that we have to partner in order to prevent those sorts of horrific consequences, right? All the people of goodwill have to work together to fight that sort of evil. And so these partnerships are really important.
Okay, great. Chris, from your team's side, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Anything we haven't really touched on? Any other detail you'd like to get into?
I don't want to speak on behalf of the team, but like, I'm gushing. Mark, this is incredible. Like we're just so honored to have you participate in this. I'm honestly kind of speechless. I don't really have anything else to say except for thank you.
Well, I'm glad it was helpful. I do have several more minutes on elephants.
Probably we're still recording, so
Mark, why have you never seen an elephant hide in a tree?
Why?
Because they're really good at it.
Okay.
Awesome. Just for insurance, if we could maybe just do your intro one more time, and that brief sentence on what ADL does. Just do maybe a couple takes of that, and then I think we're good.
I'm Mark Cabbage. I'm a senior research fellow with the ADL's Center on Extremism. ADL is short for Anti-Defamation League. We're one of the oldest civil rights bodies in North America. We started in 1913, so we're over 100 years old, but we hardly look 90. We're devoted to fighting anti-Semitism and fighting hate, prejudice, and extremism of all kinds. That was our original mission statement. That is our mission now. And we do this in a lot of ways through working with legislators, working with law enforcement, working with educators to try to alert the public or make the public aware about extremism, about hate, about terrorism, because those are all things that threaten the democratic foundations, that threaten all of our rights.
And then lastly, is there anything else that, you know, we haven't asked you or talked about, or something that you'd like to add to anything that either I've asked you or that you've said, or something that is on your mind, or something that would be important to highlight before we go?
I don't think so. I'm just here for you guys, so.
And that's great. No, and as Chris mentioned, yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time, and we're very grateful that you and ADL have partnered with the city with us, and there's a lot of interest about this project and to hear your perspective on this, and there's a lot of interest in this video specifically as well. So yeah, we're really looking forward to tomorrow with the press conference, and then next week at the presentation to council, and we're aiming to have the video published concurrently with the council meeting. So yeah,
I think that's helping you guys tomorrow.
Yeah, we appreciate it, and we'll send you a copy of the video as well. And yeah, thanks again, and I'll leave Chris and their team to say their thanks before we head off. But yeah, really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's good to catch up, and I really enjoyed the elephant's analogies.
I was happy to do it for you guys. Hope everything goes well for you tomorrow, and I hope everything goes well next week as well. On the 16th, I guess I should say. I probably will want to talk to you guys for a little bit at some point next week about my remarks for the 16th. I wouldn't mind having a brief conversation there sometime next week.
Mark, I'll set up some time to chat. Really, there's two ways that you can participate in a council meeting. One is part of a delegation. That one's a bit touchy because you only really speak if spoken to. The role we signed you up for is one of speakers. So you get 5 minutes uninterrupted. So it's 5 minutes to really say whatever you would like to say. And then there's an opportunity for mayor and council to ask you questions if they have any. So it would be the floor is yours for 5 minutes to contribute however you feel is best. But I will set up some time for us to chat next week, and looking forward to that.
All right, great.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, everyone. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Casey. Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Thank you all.
Take care. Good to see you.